The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, the first Sunday of every year is part of the, as I said, kind of the first, around the first week of October, is called Earth Care Week. And it's a Buddhist kind of day, a period, to care for the earth and focus on the earth. Kind of like Earth Day in the April, but this is a week for Buddhists. And a little, and so today is that day to give a talk on that topic. And what I'd like to start off by saying is that caring for the earth and caring for oneself many times are the same thing. They overlap. I mean, sometimes we can care for one or the other, but they overlap. And over time, over the last decades, that overlap has become stronger and stronger, bigger and bigger. And where the circumstance of the earth, the ecology of the earth, how the earth is kind of, the ecology is unfolding and being destroyed and being shifted, has a huge impact on human well-being. And without caring for the earth, some of the major disruptions in human life will occur. So the caring for the earth is caring for oneself, caring for us humans. And many ways, caring for ourselves, learning how to care for ourselves deeply, especially with what opens up through Buddhist meditation, is also a way that we can care for the world. And this idea that that we get changed through Buddhist practice, so that our values, our orientation, or what motivates us begins to change, is one of the key features of this, you know, this path that we're on. And one of those features, kind of part of the culture of awakening, is that certainly is caring, anukampa, caring for the earth, caring for others, caring for ourselves. But the radical kind of shift that is possible, I think, with you know, that's how we get changed through practice, is that instead of caring for the world, caring for the earth, being motivated by obligation, being motivated by a strong kind of adherence to responsibilities or to rights, human rights. Human rights are extremely important, but justifying caring for the world because people have rights is certainly a worthy thing to do. But what comes out of awakening is a different orientation, different basis for doing the same actions, but coming from a different place. And it comes from generosity. It comes from goodwill and comes from care. And that's a motivating force. And so there's not a should, there's not an obligation, there's not guilt, there's not anger and blame, and it's not being motivated by fear. All those kinds of things get settled in this practice to a remarkable degree. But it gives us access to other sources of action, other sources of motivation. That for Buddhists can supersede or take priority over arguments of that we should do things based on human rights or based on human responsibilities that we have. But this only works, only works if we act from, and really act maybe passionately from, our goodwill, our care, and our generosity. If we simply talk about it and say, this is, you know, that's, a, and don't do anything, then I think we have to fall back on things like responsibilities and human rights, and in order to really take those seriously, in order to really care for the suffering planet we live in. But we live now in this changing world, of course, that now here in California we're facing multiple challenges, and other places in the world are facing multiple challenges. In addition to the coronavirus. Here in California, we're facing lots of fires. And week after week, of really smoky air that it's, some people are, it's a health hazard now, but for everyone who's smoking, living this, they say that the accumulation of this kind of ongoing smoke is will affect not necessarily our well-being in the short term, but might shorten our lifetime because of the stress and the challenges it adds to the system. And then we have heat waves after heat waves. Sometimes we have all this heat, and we have drought that's happening, that not enough rain. And then we have in other places in the United States, we have hurricanes and tropical storms that are coming in and flooding. And so the environmental challenges are huge that we go in and we have, we're living under. And some of them clearly have to do not with the interface between how humans live and the growing population and growing places where growing use of resources, natural resources, that interface with the human world and the non-human world has reached its limit to how much it can sustain, how much the world can sustain human growth, human consumption, without coming to the homeostasis begins shifting and changing in some big way. And here in California, it's most clear with all the fires that some of the challenges with the fires is that we've pushed into fire zones with towns and homes and everything that then have to be defended from fires. Fires have been part of this environment for centuries. But the last century, there's been a lot of fire suppression. And so, of course, then there's a lot more dry wood and shrubs and things ready to burn. A couple of years ago, 2-3 years ago, I met a Native American elder who lives in the mountains not far from here. And he remembers that when he was a child, he would go with his father and grandfather. Every year they'd go deeper into the mountains. And one of the things they would do is they would do small fires, a regular thing. They do fires, I think he said, 1 to 10 acre fires in the fall. And that was part of their care and tending for the places where they lived in the mountains. And then in the 1960s, the Forest Service came and told his father they had to stop. And because now they weren't going to allow any fires. And so, but now, 50 years later or more, the Forest Service is coming to him, who only has a child's memory, to learn from him what did they know about making small those kinds of prescribed burns, those kinds of fires. They did it at a time of year that was usually not considered safe. They seem to have done it safely, and so how do they know to do it? What could we learn today from the ancient lore that had been learned over many, many generations by the Native Americans? I read recently about a man who, same thing, where his father was also a Native American, the Sierras, and his father stopped doing similar burns up there when he got a ticket from a fine from the Forest Service for burning illegally, even though his people had been doing it for generations. And so how do we care? How do we tend? How do we cooperate with the natural world so we live in some kind of harmony with it, rather than, because we can't just keep pushing and pushing into the limits without something breaking and something coming back and changing. And so caring for the world becomes caring for ourselves. And how do we do that? Not from duty, not from guilt, not from obligation, all of which, if nothing else works, is necessary. But how do we do it from generosity and real genuine sense of care and goodwill and energetically so? What do we do? How do we do this? So I have, thinking about this, I thought about a story from the Vinaya, from the books about the code of conduct for the monastics. They have a lot of stories there. And they have stories that attribute to the Buddha's lives, and some of them seem more fable-like, but who knows, maybe they're true. And here's one where the Buddha encounters the natural world, and natural world that could be seen as dangerous. And and his response and how he responded to that. Just like we're facing this coronavirus, we're facing fires, we're facing smoke, all these things. How do we face that? How do we show up for it? So the story has to do with the Buddha's relative, either a cousin or a nephew, named Devadatta. And Devadatta was a monk ordained by the Buddha, but he wanted to take over the order of monks. He wanted to be the leader. So he was jealous or had a quest for power or something. And so at one point, he tried to, a few points, three times, he tried to kill the Buddha. And the third time, the first time he tried to get some assassins to kill the Buddha, but when they came to the Buddha, somehow the presence of the Buddha just changed their minds, and they, rather than killing him, sat down and learned from him. The second time, Devadatta rolled a rock down from a mountain cliff down on top of the Buddha, and it missed the Buddha, but the rock shattered, and a sliver of the rock punctured the Buddha's foot, and he bled, and he was injured a little bit. A third time, Devadatta went to the royal stables, and he up to the people who were caring for the royal elephants. And elephants back then were kind of like Bradley tanks for the modern world. They were animals of war that were quite impressive, and they were trained to fight and trained to kill, apparently. So he went to these royal elephant stables, and he told the people who worked there that he was a relative of the king, and he'd come to ask them for help, and he would give them lots of rewards if he helped them. And that would be that they would take the elephant out one morning and place it at the head of some street that the Buddha was expected to walk down. And when the Buddha started to walk down the street, the elephant was to charge the Buddha and to kill him. So the Buddha got up in the morning and went out for alms into town. And when he came to this street, sure enough, the elephant was let loose and came charging down the street for the Buddha. Apparently it was a long ways away, because three times people who were nearby told the Buddha to run away. Each time the Buddha says no. He said, Buddhas don't run away from danger. Something like that. And so the Buddha just stood there and stood there calmly and peacefully and stood there facing the Buddha, facing the elephant. And as the elephant was coming towards him, the Buddha filled his heart with goodwill, with loving kindness for the elephant. And as the elephant came closer, it slowed down, and then it got close enough, it actually got down on its knees, bent down, and laid there on the ground in front of the Buddha, and ended his charge and didn't kill the Buddha. And so that was the end of the story. The Buddha then was not harmed. So it's kind of a fable, but it's a fable which I think lends itself to interpretation. And the interpretation is that in the face of nature, the dangers of nature, which there certainly are, that one of the things to do is to look at it, to really stop and take a good, honest look, to study it, understand what's really going on. And whether it's understanding climate change or understanding something locally, what's happening with your local creeks. Are there any creeks, rivers, waterways near your home? And do you really know what's happening to them? I was very surprised after now living in Redwood City almost 20 years. The other day I went for a walk and I discovered a creek I'd never seen before. And it's right next to the high school, and it's sandwiched between, it's only maybe 10 feet area, fences on either side protecting it. And there are reeds and little bushes and little trees growing in this little waterway. And I was just fascinated that this exists in Redwood City. I thought most of the creeks were covered over by asphalt. And so now I go by there and I'm studying it. So do we face and study the dangers, study what's happening? Face it and see it, look at it. And this ability, you know, it's a basic practice of mindfulness. We stop and we look. We stop and we learn. We pay attention to things. It's a little different when it's something about what's happening in the environment, the world, because it's more than just offering kind of a silent attention and noting practice to what's happening. It also involves studying it and learning more about it. And then the Buddha offered his goodwill and his maybe his generosity and his care for the elephant. So to come from goodwill, this is one of the most important teachings of the, I don't know most important, but one of the most very important teachings of the Buddha about how to live in the world is to live in the world with goodwill. He put this at such a high level of importance, and using, again, the way religious teachings use hyperbole, he said, even if bandits capture you and are, sorry for how graphic this is, and are cutting off your arms, do not give in to ill will. Maintain a heart of goodwill. And now, he didn't say don't try to escape. In other situations, he says it's fine, it's appropriate to escape danger like that if someone's going to harm you. But I think this kind of thought experiment is when it's hopeless to be escaped. And even in this kind of extreme situation, maintain goodwill for the bandits. I don't know if we want to kind of take this literally exactly, but what it points to is the tremendous value this tradition puts on having a heart that doesn't succumb to hostility, doesn't get caught in the grip of fear, doesn't get caught up in greed and desires and consumption, but a heart that is able to stay close to that place, I would like to say natural place, tender place, maybe tender place, where these beautiful qualities of heart can be here, compassion and kindness, friendliness, goodwill, and care, generosity, that this is our inner wealth. This is also part of the natural world, how we are in our hearts. And if we want to do self-care, we want to be careful that we don't lose, destroy, cover over the richest parts of our natural inner life. And ironically, or maybe not so ironically, the very forces of the mind that destroy the inner life or cover it over or make it inaccessible, greed, hatred, and delusion, are the very same forces that humans are living with that are hugely responsible for so much of the environmental damage that's going on for the world. And in this way, this caring for ourselves and caring for the world, at its heart, has a common denominator. And the common denominator is to clarify and purify ourselves of forces of greed, hate, and delusion. And in doing so, also overcoming unwholesome fear, unhelpful fear, that humans are often drive human life and drive us to make terrible decisions and politically, economically, and socially. So to begin to care, to look, and to appreciate the tremendous overlap between the world, the earth, and the environment, and our human life. And to take an honest look at this, including an honest look at ourselves. Some 5 years ago when I had the statistics, there was this idea that 7% of the human population are responsible for 50% of the carbon dioxide emissions. Reverse that, and they say 50% of the human beings on the planet, 3.5 billion, are the poorest people, are responsible for only 7% of the carbon dioxide emission. That's really lopsided. But we can't just simply increase everything for the poor so their carbon dioxide consumption goes up, production goes up as much as it is for the developed world. But we also want to, there has to be some change in what the developed world does, a radical change. Radical change in consumption and lifestyle, all kinds of things. And then, so then I use the language there needs to be, which now becomes a language of obligation. But from this other, from the culture of awakening, it becomes recognizing this disparity between the haves and the have-nots. And then from generosity, from care, from goodwill, and from joy, to look for a new way of living, to look towards a life of simplicity, look for how to consume less, how to have less negative impact on the world and on those on the underprivileged people, the poor. How can those who have the means use the means to reduce damage that their lives are contributing to the world? And no one feels like they're damaging themselves, and so we don't want to shame anyone, make it obligatory, but how about for ourselves? How do we come from the best qualities of heart so we're inspired and want to do it? We're happy to change. That's the task. And if we're going to really make a difference in this world, I think it's going to help a lot if, rather than the burden of change, we discover, we work towards, try to experience the joy of change. We're moving towards a better lifestyle, towards a better way of living. We find how we enhance the wealth in our own heart, enhance the ecology of the heart, so that ecology shines and is rich and valuable, so that the work we do for the environment, for social justice, for environmental justice, for the welfare of the world around us, really feeds us, nourishes us from beautiful places within. I think that would be the culture of awakening as we engage in earth care. So this is Earth Care Week. We're kind of in the middle of it. So maybe for this week and for every week, but especially this week, maybe you could make this a little bit of a theme for over the next week. How you can care for the world more than you are already, and maybe not to make it and do that in a way that is not obligatory, not heavy, but really comes from a place of lightness and joy, but does make a difference. So those are my thoughts for today for Earth Care Week, and thank you for listening and then we have a couple of minutes before 10:30. I can say that might be nice to tell you that one of the things I've done in this regard is, after many years of having this wish, finally being able to actualizing it, is that co-created with Susie Harrington and Kirsten Rudstam a training program for Buddhist eco-chaplains, people who offer spiritual care in relationship to the non-human world, to the environment and our relationship to the environment, the ecosystem. And we finished one whole program that ended in September. It was a fantastic group of people, and it was really inspiring to see their dedication and love and activities they were setting themselves up to do as eco-chaplains. So that was a wonderful thing. So that's an example of something that's been part of my life and my joy to offer. And we're going to start that again. I think in January we start the next year of training. So thank you. I'm going to stop now and then here on YouTube in a few minutes. And I'm going to set up the Zoom room. It'll be probably open before I get there, but I think Bev Spiker will say hello to people, and I hope it all works. I chose a big Zoom account, and I hope for this time we get in happily, all of us. So thank you for today.